I'm Joy Manning, a freelance writer focused on food and health.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, creator of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk shop with obsessed home cooks everywhere. This week, we're talking about faux fish tacos, potato hash, and sharp knives. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. So, there's a new mystery.
Yes.
And it's been dubbed Buttergate.
You know, what's funny is that I've watched this whole thing unfold on Instagram because the reporter who first started doing the research, Julie Van Rosendahl, is sort of we've been friendly acquaintances in the food world for a decade or more. And so I follow her on Instagram. And so I watched her stories as she was starting to figure this out. And so it's been very fun to watch the whole thing come to be. But essentially, go ahead.
I just wanted, can you explain it for people that have not been following the story?
Sure. So essentially, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, Julie started, you know, bringing up the topic that, hey, why is Canadian butter, even at room temperature, so hard? And so she bought a whole bunch of butter, tested it out, and then started to do some research. And people started telling her that it is the addition of palmic acid, a palm oil byproduct to cattle feed in Canada because and it's a supply chain thing, you know. So during the pandemic, a lot of the cattle feed that had been coming from Europe couldn't get here, couldn't get to Canada. And so they need to have a certain level of butter fat in the butter. And so to maintain the level of butter fat that they needed to without increasing the number of cows, which they weren't able to, they had to increase the amount of saturated fat they added to the cow feed in order to maintain the proper amount of fat in the butter. But palm oil has, it's like it's a different chemical compound. And so it is solid at room temperature. And that is impacting the quality of Canadian butter.
I also read that the dairy industry has just been under a lot of pressure to produce more butter.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, this article from NPR, which I'll share the link, was looking at Canadian butter specifically, but I don't imagine the U.S. would be that much different. The pandemic drove up demand for butter by 22% last year.
Yeah.
So that meant, you know, the dairy industry needed to churn more out. No pun intended.
We should link to Julie's original article. I think it was in the Globe and Mail too, because it was really interesting to see, like, she really just tracked down what was happening in Canadian butter. And now this is, I believe, we've had these additives in American butter for a long time because it's cheaper. And it explains why, like, I know you're not eating butter anymore, but, you know, it's like I buy plain old stick butter for like baking, but I have Kerrygold for like spreading on toast. Mm-hmm. And the quality, the consistency of the Kerrygold is always so different. You know, it's much softer, even from the fridge, than like, you know, grocery store stick butter is. And I always assumed that it was a European versus American thing, but obviously like it's more, a little bit more nuanced than that. And it's this issue of what the cows are being fed and these palm oil additives.
Right. And we should also say it's legal to feed your cows palm oil. But I guess the question that the NPR article was raising at least was, is that ethical?
Yeah.
I just pulled a quote out that said there's a complete disconnect between animal feed practices and how these food products impact the health of consumers. Like, and that to me is obviously true across the whole food supply. And I think it's a pretty important question. This is just another example of industries putting profits over people. And it's just so consistently disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did think the article mentioned that it's not affecting organic butter, maybe because there's more regulation around what the cows can eat.
Yeah.
So anyway, I wonder if when you're looking at the Instagram reports, people have noticed it in American butter?
Basically, they said our butter's always been shitty.
Oh.
And it's true. Like, you know, conventional grocery store butter has not been good for years. So
I did ask Dan when I read this, because Dan still eats butter. We have two butters in the fridge. And I said, do you notice anything funny about your butter? And he's like, no, but he does buy expensive European organic butter. So
yeah, I mean the Kerrygold, the Plougra, any of the like really expensive grass-fed organic butters have this kind of soft spreadable consistency. Whereas, you know, it's like if you buy just conventional grocery store butter, which I had bought around Christmas time because I was doing a lot of baking and I sort of was like, well, you know, for my neighbors and stuff, I'm not going to like splash out on the $6 or $7 a pound butter. I was going to get the, you know, the $3 or $4 a pound butter for cookies because I figured it was fine, but we had some left and it's like you literally have to, like, hammer at it, chisel at it to get, you know, butter off of the stick if it's straight out of the fridge.
Well, I'll tell you, I have not been having that problem with Earth Balance.
I am not surprised. Anyway,
I tell you something fun I had to eat this week?
Yes, I would love that.
You know, a fish taco, like a California style fish taco, it's got like a flour tortilla and like usually like a piece of fried fish in there with some cabbage and like a mayo-y dressing.
Yeah, I love a fish taco like that.
I love those. And actually, let me take a step back. And I don't know if I've mentioned this on the podcast yet, but my mother for many years has been asking me to help her learn to cook, which is a big request.
Yeah.
Not in terms of like making the effort, but like the scope of it is like, where do you begin? And so of course I've barely seen my mother since last March. I've had one or two drive-bys at our place and she's been down here one or two times, just to like hand off a plant or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we haven't been seeing each other. She's always been asking me to cook, teach her how to cook. So I decided that once a week I was going to cook with her on Zoom and teach her a recipe from a particular cookbook, which I got her. And it's Issa Chandra Moskowitz's most recent book called I Can't Cook Vegan. Because, of course, if I'm going to teach my mom how to cook, I'm going to teach her the way I think she should eat.
Yeah.
So last week there was a recipe for fish sticks in there, like tofu fish sticks.
Mm-hmm.
Not a recipe that I might have chosen. I never really liked fish sticks to begin with. I honestly think my mom picked it for her husband, who is like, I think he's a meat and potatoes type guy. And I think she thought he would like them. And I think she was also curious about tofu for herself. Anyway, so it's just basically a breaded stick of tofu, typical, you know, coating with a batter and breadcrumbs. And then you bake it instead of fry it. Mm-hmm. And you make a tartar sauce on the side. So we made them. And I thought they were fine. My mother and her husband both liked them. So that's a win. But the next day I was looking at them and I was like, these are exactly like fish for fish tacos. Like the way they looked and like basically their texture and everything. And so then I sort of took a pivot and I was like, I'm going to make fish tacos out of my leftovers. And I did. And I thought they were so great. They were so much, to me, more interesting than a fish stick. And I guess that's my own personal palate. But now I have new ideas. I have some additional ideas about how to make it even more fish taco-y. For example, instead of, you know how when you bread or fry something, you typically do like three stations with the breading and you have like an egg in the middle.
Yeah.
Here it was flour and water that you used as an egg.
Yeah.
And I realized that I would rather use like a thickened soy milk that, you know, I stirred some lemon juice in so it like curdled and thickened as the egg, and then it would have a lemony taste.
Yeah.
Anyway, stay tuned for more on that.
The thing that does they have anything in them that makes them taste fishy?
Yes. Use like a seaweed powder.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. I feel like when you get a fish taco, the goal is to have it not taste fishy. It's usually like the mildest, whitest, flakiest type fish that there is out there.
I mean, I don't think it should taste like aggressively fishy. Just have like a little bit of the taste of the sea. And so Nori would definitely do that.
Or like kelp powder or something. Any kind of like a seaweed situation. I actually bought some vegan fish sauce that might be perfect for this. So yeah, I feel like I have definitely a part two in mind. And my mom will probably continue to make them as fish sticks, but she might like tacos too. Anyway, that was like a delightful discovery. One of those times where you take leftovers that you're feeling kind of meh about and you turn them into something really fun.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So
speaking of that, shall we pivot to the next thing? Because that's exactly what I did. So I made a big batch of potato hash this week, which is something that I remember on occasion and then I forget about and I don't make for like a year. But I had a bunch of leftovers this week. I had made like two big sheet pans of roasted vegetables and I cooked some chicken. So I had, you know, some roasted cauliflower. I had some roasted Brussels sprouts. I had a couple roasted potatoes or like pieces of roasted potato. But I still had a ton of potatoes. And so I thought the highest thing I can do with these leftovers, because they were all kind of soggy on their own, was to saute up a big onion. I had a bunch of green peppers, so cut up a couple green peppers, add a bunch of garlic, add all my leftovers. Then I boiled earlier in the day, I made this for dinner, I boiled some red potatoes. And so I boiled them, I cooled them, and then I cut them up. And so I just kind of, you know, cooked all of that stuff together. I cut up the chicken and added it, and it got kind of, you know, brown and crispy in the way that like any pan crisp potato dish gets. And it was so good. And we ate it for dinner out of, you know, flat pasta bowls with a little bit of ketchup on top. And it was so satisfying. And and it's one of those things that I need to remember. And so that's why I wanted to talk about it today, because it's so good. And you can use whatever leftovers you have. You can certainly make it vegetarian or vegan. You know, leave out the chicken, you could add some of your soy curls. You could, add some beans to it. That would be really good too. But I mean, really all that it takes to do is, you know, heat a big skillet. I used cast iron. In the future, I might use nonstick so that I don't have to use quite as much oil, because I used a little bit more than I like. And, you know, big onion, cut it up, start sauteing it, add some garlic. Any pepper will do. And if you don't like peppers, certainly leave it out. Celery would also be good. And then you add your chopped up, sort of cooked and cold potatoes and put them in and let them sit for a minute so they start to get a little bit of crustiness on them. And, you know, once everything is cooked through and the potatoes have crusted up a bit, you add your leftovers. So you kind of cook the sog out of your leftovers. You know, I added a big palmful of dried rosemary, but any kind of dried herb would be really good. I added an extra hit of garlic powder for like that extra kind of umaminess of it. You know, plenty of salt, because potatoes can take a lot of salt. And it was so good. It's not, certainly not fancy cooking, but it's very satisfying. You could put an egg on top. You could melt some cheese on top if that's the way you wanted to go. It was just really.
Was it like flippable or was it crumbly?
It's crumbly. It's sort of crumbly. Like a, it's definitely hashy. Like it wasn't like a potato pancake. It was like a big sort of skillet potato dish.
Mm-hmm. You just sort of scraped onto your plates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good.
That's not something I make a lot, but it is so important to have those recipes that absorb your leftovers.
Yeah.
Kitchen inventory management is an ongoing challenge, I think. I've been using I think I talked about this a couple weeks ago, the chickpea flour frittata for that mm-hmm. purpose.
Yeah.
Just like scraping all your leftover vegetables into it. Yeah,
and I
does sound like the type of thing that was dying for an egg. Not that I eat eggs anymore,
egg would have been great. But honestly, ketchup was really pretty good on top. And if I had an open jar of homemade ketchup, I would have used that. But I have so many open jars in my fridge right now that I didn't want to open anything else. I should have put a dollop of chutney alongside. That would have been really good.
I love ketchup.
Yeah. I mean, ketchup is great. I have no qualms about using ketchup.
I've never had a homemade one that I prefer to Heinz.
I make a beet ketchup that is the closest I have gotten. It's so good, Joy.
Are there tomatoes?
No, it's just beets. And so you can actually use less sugar, because ketchup has a ton of sugar in it. But because beets are so sweet.
I consider ketchup a sweetener, like flat out.
Yeah, Yeah. But because beets are so sweet, it has all the spices, you know, like the cinnamon and the cloves that you get in regular ketchup. But the beets lend so much sweetness that it's very lightly sweetened. The recipe's in my Naturally Sweet book, actually. So I think I sweetened it with, coconut sugar. But it's so good. It is. And the beets, because they're kind of a dense vegetable, it doesn't have mm-hmm. to cook down as much as a tomato ketchup does. It's actually shockingly delicious. And it's bright pink, which.
But would you mistake it for ketchup, or is it Is it different? Like, tell me.
Visually, you wouldn't mistake it for ketchup.
But it
flavor-wise, like you could say, "Huh, this very much tastes like commercial ketchup."
Well, that's interesting. But commercial ketchup, I heartily endorse as a sauce. I tried to avoid it for years because it is basically a sweetener. But yeah. So what?
I confess, I have started letting my children have a little bit of ketchup. Like, I made them basically salmon nuggets the other night. And they liked them, but they kind of slowed down and didn't eat as much as I needed them to eat in order for them to have a good night's sleep. So we pulled out the bottle of ketchup and dipped some of their nuggets in ketchup, and they were happy to eat it then.
I think it was my niece when she was a little older than your kids, but still pretty young. I just like saw her in complete glee about ketchup. And I was like, you know what? Ketchup is good.
Yeah.
And I started to embrace it more again.
I love ketchup.
Kids know what's up.
They know what tastes good. It's true.
Again, I don't eat tons of it, but when like something like a potato hash, or I have had it with my chickpea flour frittata or potatoes of all kinds. Like, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Should we talk about knives?
Let's talk about knives.
Okay.
A very important part of our kitchen.
Oh, absolutely.
Time. So tell me what you got.
So for years I've been using this like little really cruddy handheld one sort of bladed knife sharpener. It doesn't really sharpen. It sort of just recorrects the edge. And
a honing tool.
Yeah. And then in between, there used to be a knife sharpener guy who came to the Rittenhouse Square Farmer's Market. And so I would take my knives to him, you know, maybe two or three times a year and, you know, for a real good checkup. And he stopped coming, and then the pandemic hit. And so my knives have just been terrible. And a while back, I ordered this little three-wheel ceramic water sharpener called MinoSharp Plus 3. And I think I read an article and it recommended it, and I ordered it and I put it in a cabinet and I never used it. And so earlier this week, I pulled it out and it was a revelation. It was so easy. The wheels are, you just work from left to right, from coarse to fine. You put some water in it. You pull the knife through each one of the wheels like 7 to 10 to 15 times, depending on how much sharpening it needs. And when you're done, you're left with a super sharp, beautifully honed knife that is ready to chop away. And it has revolutionized my kitchen life. I didn't realize how dull my knives had gotten.
It sounds like a easier version of the whetstone sharpening.
Yeah, because
I have them too. Dan knows how to do it. I don't, because the scary part is like you have to get it at the exactly right angle.
Yeah, and I've never been good at that.
So it sounds like the device that you bought that does that for you.
Yeah,
by virtue of its design.
No, it's totally. This is not a phrase I use a lot, but idiot proof. And because sometimes I can be the idiot who screws something up because I haven't read the instructions correctly or I get distracted. And so this was something I could use while, a small child was whining at the kitchen gate saying, you know, wanting my attention. And it was so easy and so useful. So I'm really, really glad I got it and finally pulled it out of the cabinet. And, I'm going to use it on a regular basis now.
Do you recall what it costs?
I don't. I could let me see. I'm
just wondering.
I probably have the receipt in my email.
It sounds like something that was like not so expensive.
No, I don't think it was crazy expensive at all. Why don't you tell us about your knife sharpening? I'll see if I can find the receipt in my email.
Sure. I for years wanted an electric knife sharpener because I just knew that I was never going to get the whetstones out, like, or learn that. That just seems so intimidating to me. But Dan was against it because he feels that an electric knife sharpener might peel off too much metal and like prematurely age your knives. So time went by. I would sometimes take my knives to Fonte's to get sharpened, but not often enough. Like, it's hard to overstate the ease of having sharp knives and like how much easier it makes chopping an onion, which is such a fundamental kitchen task, for example, or like You know, if you have a properly sharp knife, it can dice a tomato, which most people's knives are not sharp enough to do. So sometimes when I want something that Dan doesn't want me to have, I ask my mother to buy it for me for an occasion. And that's and that's how the knife sharpener came into my life one Christmas. And now I have the Chef's Choice electric knife sharpener, and I love it. Before the pandemic, I was using it pretty often because, you know, you don't have to take the knife all the way back to the most heavy duty grinding stage. You can just use the honing station if it's just needs a little help, or even like the one right before that. I kept it on the counter. I used it pretty regularly. My knives were always sharp. And then after the pandemic, Dan's home all the time. I know he doesn't want me to overuse the knife sharpener and threaten the longevity of our knives. So I wasn't using them. And then one day I just was like, we've got to get these knives sharpened. And I pulled it out and sharpened all my knives, and it made a big difference. I think I took advantage of the fact that Dan was already angry at me for something. So I thought I would just add it to the grievances. And it's time to do it again, I have to say. That was a few months ago. And now I, especially talking to you about having the enthusiasm of just recently doing it.
Yeah.
It's so nice to have a sharp knife. Oh, cutting a big bunch of leafy greens, especially cutting the onion. Like, cause that's something I do in almost everything that I cook. Like, if chopping an onion is a drag to you, like, probably your knife isn't sharp enough.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that my knives were not sharp enough when, like, my onion was, like, cracking along the cuts as opposed to cutting through cleanly.
Yeah, that's a sign.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you've noticed now that you have a nice sharp knife?
We're going to talk about citrus and what we're loving, but a lot of days for breakfast, I will cut up, like, a grapefruit into wedges to eat. And the cuts on the citrus are so sharp, so clean. They're so satisfying.
Are you supreming it?
Like, no, I leave the peel on and I cut it into wedges, and then I eat it off the wedges like I'm a elementary school soccer player.
Sounds good. I like that. Why don't we transition to your winter citrus celebration? We moved it to this, what we're loving, instead of our previous locker segment, because I have had very little citrus this winter, but I want to hear about all yours.
I have been going a little crazy for the, citrus this year because, I'm just like dying for that brightness, and it's really been doing it for me. So I have been getting, I went to Trader Joe's a couple weeks ago, and they always have a bunch of really affordable citrus. And so I, got a big bag of red grapefruit. I got, blood oranges. I got, clementines. I've also been getting, citrus through Hungry Harvest boxes. And they've had the, miniolas for like 37 cents a piece. And so I've gotten like 10 miniolas, which feels like this crazy abundance.
What's a miniola?
It's one of the kind of specialty large clementine. They're kind of tart and sweet. And so I have really been just going crazy for citrus. I have a giant bowl in my dining room right now that's just bursting with citrus. I'm also, you know, feeding clementines and little bits of supreme orange to the boys, and they really enjoy it. And I've been doing so much with it as well. So I, in addition to just kind of cutting them up into wedges and eating them, I have really been going heavy on blood orange juice in sparkling water. It's sort of like my own version of, Spindrift. And it makes
only better.
It gives it this really beautiful kind of pink color. It's so good. I have been making soups where I add a bunch of lemon juice to kind of brighten it, and that's been really good and satisfying. What else have I been doing? I've made at least one batch of marmalade. I started a second batch, and it's sort of in. I've completed one batch of marmalade. I have a second batch that's sort of in limbo in the fridge right now, where it's cooked but not canned. What else have I done? I made a yogurt loaf cake that had lots of lemon and lemon zest in it, and that was really delicious. It's like it has been my like shield against winter blahs and blues. And it's been really effective. I mean, I am eating like 3 to 4 pieces of citrus a day. And I feel like it's the only thing keeping off the really kind of heavy darkness of winter. And now that it's gotten a little bit warmer and a little bit lighter, it's been really the combination. I'm almost giddy. But yeah,
the citrus, I do think, is like a form of aromatherapy.
Yeah. Oh, God. It smells so good.
You know, I've been using Philly Foodworks as my primary source for food, and I have ordered a few oranges and grapefruits from them this winter, but they haven't been very good. You know, when you peel one and they're kind of like dry and mealy inside?
Yeah, the ones I've gotten from Philly Foodworks haven't been great, and they're really expensive. Other places, I would suggest that maybe the next time you treat yourself to an actual in-person grocery shop that you go crazy on the citrus.
Yeah, I did make a cookie, an orange cookie with chocolate cookie with candy orange rind in it. And it was like delightful.
That sounds really good.
Because even like that, the dry mealy oranges that I speak of, you can still candy their peel, and like chocolate and orange is such a winning combination. Lemons have been fine. Last night I made a salad dressing that was like mostly lemon juice, to be honest. It was like when I make a salad with lots of avocado, which I love, and any salad I make that I put a lot of avocado in, I call a California salad. But at the same time, it's my opinion that if you pack your salad with something that is fatty, like avocado or like lots of nuts or whatever, then you need the usual ratio in a dressing is like 1 part acid, 3 parts fat.
Yeah, you need more acid.
I typically default to more of like a 1-to-1 ratio, but when it comes to a California salad that has tons of avocado in it, it's really just like just a drop of oil and tons of lemon juice, garlic, nutritional yeast, salt. That's that's how I dress up my California salad. Just squeezing the lemon and then like having that lemony salad is really, really good.
I do have one more thing that I wanted to mention that I forgot to say. Fennel orange salad, which
I love fennel.
Is so good. You know, so a bunch of supremed oranges and just the thinnest shavings of fennel and lots of salt and olive oil. You can add some olives if you really want to go in on the like, you know, kind of bitter, rich flavors. It's so good. It's not something that Scott eats, but I will sometimes make for lunch for myself and let him have a sandwich. It's so good. Years and years and years ago, I did a recipe. It's still on Serious Eats for a fennel and orange pickle, which you leave the rind on the orange and layer thinly sliced fennel with thinly sliced orange and then top it with vinegar. Oh God, it's so, I haven't made it in years, but it's so good and it lasts forever in the fridge. So that's a really great one to find as well.
I'm kind of recalling a salad at one of the many Italian restaurants in South Philly that's basically just shaved fennel, orange segments, green olives, and red onion and oregano.
Yeah.
And I really loved that.
Sign me up for that. I want to go back to our knife segment because I found the receipt for my knife sharpener.
Oh, yeah. So what did you pay for that thing?
I paid $63.96 from Sur La Table 2 years ago. So I think it was a sale. But for a really great knife sharpener, not bad and certainly cheaper than, you know, taking it.
The electric one is like in the $125 range, I think.
Yeah, this one has really
half that.
Half that, and it's great, and it takes 2 minutes a knife. Not bad,
right? Yeah. So, eat your citrus and sharpen your knives is what we're telling you.
Absolutely.
If you need like a little pick me up to get through this last part of winter,
and then sharpen your knives and then eat your citrus because then your oranges and your grapefruits will be so beautifully cut.
Yes, and you'll enjoy cutting them more. That's the thing. Like anything you can do that makes you enjoy your tasks in the kitchen more is more than worth it to me. You want to make it fun and
easy. It's true. There is such pleasure to cutting with a very sharp knife. Like it goes through the food so much more beautifully, like smoothly, and it makes a better sound on your cutting board.
And it's safer.
Yeah. I did have to warn Scott, if you sharpen your knives and your partner doesn't do a lot of cooking, make sure to warn them if all the knives are very sharp all of a sudden, because if they're used to them being dull, it's a shock. So I had to warn Scott after I had done it that all the knives were really sharp.
Generally speaking, though, you're much less likely to cut yourself with a sharp knife because you're not fumbling around with it and it's not slipping off your food.
It's true. But if you're used to applying the kind of pressure you need for a dull knife and suddenly everything is moving at higher speed, you can hurt yourself. So
right. Well, he was okay, right?
He did not hurt himself there. He whacked his head on a shelf changing a diaper recently, but he has not injured himself with the knives.
Excellent. Yes. That's what we like to hear.
Exactly. Well, I think that's probably about it for this episode of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.